There's a lot that's really useful and convenient and cool about today's technology and its applications. Stuff like Facebook and Blackberries, Twitter and iPhones have paved the way for a life of nearly total connectedness. But now that we're so wired, have we put true solitude on the endangered species list? I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, are we ever really alone in the wired world, and why should we care if alone time is going out of style? Our guest this morning is Neil Swiety. He's a writer for the Boston Globe magazine. His article, The End of Alone, appeared in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. And I hope you'll call in, tell us about your own experience. Are you still comfortable being alone in the wired world, or do you think we're becoming a world afraid of solitude? Call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Neil Swiety, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Veronica. It's great to be here.
Well, in the beginning of your article, you tell a story about being in church on Christmas morning, and you notice a guy back there with his Bluetooth on. Was that the moment you kind of started thinking about what it means to really unplug and how reluctant we are to do that?
I think that for me, that was the tipping point. You know, you sort of look around in church and you hear the chirping and the whispering, and you sort of think, have we passed that point where people stop even being cognizant of how connected and addicted to technology they are?
Well, what do you think drives us to get plugged in and stay that way instead of being sort of more moderate, maybe like checking your email once a day? Why do we go so full overboard with the technology of being connected?
It is interesting. I mean, technology, I think, because it makes life so much easier and it allows us to manage more relationships and manage our life in our career, home life balance, there's so much good in that, as you alluded to at the beginning, that I think we start on that road. But then I think that there is anxiety that fuels our need to check constantly. Part of that might be, you know, the economic anxiety now of what's going on. Am I doing what I need to be doing? Is there something happening somewhere that I'm not aware of that I should be aware of? So I think there is an undercurrent of uncertainty that fuels the excessive reliance on technology, even if technology is born from, a very good place.
Well, just taking a look at the social aspect of it for a minute, you know, it seems like it's a great boon if you want to keep in touch with a whole bunch of people, more than we ever could have kept touch with before. But on the other hand, you know, I know a lot of people who feel like Facebook has made them sort of socially anxious. You know, why aren't people posting on their page? And if they're not on every second of the day, you know, what's happening that they're missing? And are they missing something simply by not being present there? I mean, it seems like a whole new set of social anxieties are cropping up.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it also, what you see is in this almost atavistic way of high school anxieties coming back in the Facebook era of, is this person friending me? Why is this person friending this person, not another person? my goal, in Facebook is to keep my friend's number lower. But it's hard to do that.
But don't you think people then think you're a loser?
Yeah. That's okay. I guess the only problem is when you get a friend request from someone in high school that you stopped speaking to for whatever reason midway through high school, and now you're supposed to be connected with their life. I mean, there is a sort of uncertain kind of nature of what exactly this is all about. And one of the things that I found interesting is a study that actually looked at the equivalent of Facebook in Japan and the optimal number of friends that people had. Some researchers studied this, and their optimal number was like 49. And in the U.S. for Facebook, it was, I think, like 230 or something.
Right.
And, you know, what you understood from that is that the intimacy of that friend had more of a meaning when you have a smaller pool.
Well, and I know some people have worried about the fact that if we have, let's say, 85 sort of more like acquaintance friends Are we diluting the friendship with our, say, three or four closest friends?
I think that's true. I think there's only, you know, there's only so much time that you have. Now, what technology does and why it's become so prevalent, why we've become so reliant on it, is it does expand somewhat that ability to manage multiple friendships and relationships and kind of keep tabs on them. But it doesn't scale up by orders of magnitude in the way that technology allows it. So I still think you have to make choices on who you're talking to and whose lives you're invested in versus who you're just sort of tangentially keeping tabs on, which, again, Facebook can allow for. But I think this all goes back to this whole idea of what's being lost in this sort of pursuit, this aggressive pursuit for keeping tabs with everyone in this constant connectedness. And I think there is something being lost, and that is our ability to just be alone with ourselves.
So you're worried that essentially people, instead of, let's say, walking down the street by themselves, maybe having the occasional lunch just by themselves in solitude or something, people are going to be texting or calling people, anybody they can think of, so that they don't have to be alone.
I think that's exactly it. And when you asked where this began, for me, the original idea began on college campuses. You know, as a journalist, I spent a lot of time on various campuses talking with researchers and others and students, and what I started to notice was this idea of the dining hall, which I remember from my days in college not that long ago, where, you know, occasionally for whatever reason you'd be eating alone, and you'd have to figure out how to manage that and how to be comfortable with yourself with that, and sort of have other people around you be comfortable with that. And now when you go on college campuses, you seldom see anyone alone who's not interacting with someone else. So if they're sitting in a dining hall, they're texting, they're on their iPhones or Blackberries. Even if they're walking on campus, everyone's got earbuds in. Even if they're not listening to music, they keep the earbuds in
right
now. So there's an advertisement of, I've got something else going on in my life. I've got something else that's happening here. And I feel that that kind of ability to be alone and to be alone in public is muscular. It's something you learn over time, and it's a good muscle to have, and that may be atrophying now.
Well, do you think that means that we're becoming a society that's not going to be able to cope with loneliness?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a fascinating distinction between alone and loneliness. Loneliness is bad. You know, it's bad for your health. There's been some fascinating research that I came across when I was researching this piece about just how bad it can be and how much of a drain on your mental state and your physical state that excessive loneliness can be. But alone is something different, and alone is not bad. And I think one of the things that I found in that research is that people who were by themselves did not necessarily have higher rates of feeling lonely than people who weren't. So that people could be lonely in a crowd, and that may be kind of where we're heading on there now. I just think that there is some piece in it, and again, I started this piece and I stressed it all the way through that I am not a Luddite. I am a technology file, a technophile, and I, you know, use it and love it. I'm a heavy user. I just think that we need to step back at some point and say, well, what are the consequences of this, and has this gone to excess? And are there times in history where you look back and find solitude was a condition in many cases for some of the great works and great advances in science and philosophy and other things? There were thinkers had huge chunks of solitude, and I just wonder how possible that is now.
Well, it seems like, you know, what you said about loneliness or alone time being muscular, it seems exactly right, because it seems as though you kind of have to go through loneliness to get to the point where it's not loneliness, but it's sort of something more fertile and nourishing, sort of solitude, that sense you get of Thoreau up at the pond. You have to go through loneliness to get there, and if we never get past loneliness, we'll never get to that fertile alone time called solitude.
I think that's exactly right. And I think what's interesting in my research for this is I found students whose concept of being alone is almost a foreign concept now. You know, the disconnect and turning off state. You know, of I talked to a Canadian researcher who did a lot of great work on the use of technology and how it affects, for instance, the transitions to college in the freshman year transitions. But one of the things she talked about is, you know, this tradition in Canada of going to the cottage, disconnecting for the summer, and that there is, it's almost gotten to the point where she was saying that students don't even understand the appeal. Not only aren't they not interested in it, they don't get it on some philosophical level because the disconnect seems pointless.
Do you think maybe what we're talking about is a generational thing? You've got two young daughters, as you say in your article, so I gather you're I gather you're in your 30s or something like that. But do you think maybe that what you're talking about now is a worry that someone in their 30s or 40s or 50s would have? But if you're 20 and younger, you say, well, this is just the way we are now, and we know how to be alone, but we choose not to be alone. Maybe, do you think we're worrying about maybe nothing here?
I don't think we're worrying about nothing, but I do very much agree with the idea that we shouldn't exaggerate this, and that I see in the fluency in technology and the comfort with technology that younger people have, I see a lot of good in that, and I'd like to try to trumpet that, because you know, this idea, when we look at kids now, we see this miasma of multitasking. That's all they're doing, you know, doing four or five things at once. And we think, what is going on? But if the future that they're going to be living in is going to be full of all these multiple data streams, then that's actually, we're building those muscles and toning them now. That's a good thing. So I agree with all that. I'm just saying, in all of this, it's healthy, I think, to step back and say, wait, do we need to actually inject something out so that it doesn't get so weighted to the side of managing multiple data streams that we actually can't be alone in our own mind, in our own single data stream?
But have you found evidence that people don't want to be alone in their own mind?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's found both scientific evidence for some of their studies that I found on that. Again, this is all sort of very preliminary research on there now, and no one's really tackled the longitudinal studies to really measure that. But the earlier, more narrow studies, I think, do show that. And also just the anecdotal one, you know, the idea of, I can't tell you how much reaction I got from this one story from people all over the world, really, you know, as it got picked up. And the stories were the interesting things to me, where people were saying, you know, thank you because I need to do this, you know, or the flip side saying, you know, this is what life is like, and you get used to it on there. But I just read something somewhere else where a writer was talking about, after reading this piece, had decided to give up Facebook and texting for Lent.
For Lent, yeah, I've heard of that before, people giving it up for Lent.
But she was doing it in a kind of Ramadan way, where she was just doing it sunrise and sunset after because she couldn't quite.
Oh, that's funny. We know my on-air producer, who's answering phone calls, said that she's given up Facebook after 5 months of being totally seduced into sort of the habit of voyeurism, I guess, peeking in on people's lives. It can be hard to look away.
It can. And I think part of the appeal of Facebook is you can, you know, infer certain things without ever communicating with these friends. So just by their interactions with other people and what their postings are, you can, and I think actually the interactions are much more telling than the Twitter-like nonsense of musings of what people are doing right now, which I still don't get, don't understand. But the interactions of your friends or acquaintances, in this case, with other their own acquaintances that you can actually, as you, your producer says, in a voyeuristic way, peek in on, those can be pretty telling. They could also be wildly off base just by the inferences you're making, but you know, I think that's part of the Facebook appeal.
Well, we need to take a quick break right now, then we'll come back and take your phone calls. We do have an open line still for you if you want to call in now. We'd like to know what you think. Are you comfortable being alone in the wired world? And do you think we are becoming a world afraid of solitude? Or is this kind of much ado about nothing? The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stay tuned next hour as we talk with a guest who says that parents, coaches, and other adults have become overly invested and involved in youth sports, often to the detriment of the young players. That's coming up at 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking with Neil Swidey, who's a writer for the Boston Globe magazine. He wrote the article, The End of Alone. The article sort of tackles the issue about whether, with our connected world, we are becoming afraid to be alone in public and kind of in our own minds as well. Our call-in number this morning is 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go ahead and take phone calls right now. And Mike is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to comment that, you know, I've had Facebook and MySpace and, you know, they started basically, you know, when I started college or late high school, I don't even remember. And like 6 months ago, I got rid of both of them at the exact same time, and I was just getting a little too invasive. But my whole quality of life now seems better. And, you know, I just want to see if, you know, found any studies on, you know, if any other people felt that way or if that's just, you know, strange for my generation. I'm 24.
Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by your quality of life being better? What's changed?
It's just, you know, I feel like I got my own personal life back. You know, I was literally obsessed with, you know, checking other people's statuses and checking it all day. And you know, I just feel like I have more time in the day to, you know, do other things, which is strange.
And do you find you miss those connections or do you still feel connected to your friends and your network?
I mean, there's some people that I stayed connected to, you know, that live in Costa Rica or wherever. But you know, overall, definitely, I do not miss the connection, and you know.
And were you jonesing for it the first few days after going cold turkey, or?
Yeah, it was. You know, I guess I could compare it to quitting smoking, which I can't do. But, yeah, it's along the similar lines. But, you know, after a while, and it's been 6 months, I don't miss it at all. Not even close.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar, Neil Swidey?
Yeah, I haven't seen any research on that, looking at that factor, that particular scenario. But it does, I think, again, make sense for the individual. When you find it's all-consuming, if you can kind of step back and do that. Now Mike's response was pretty extreme on there. Other people might be able to just sort of say, hey, you know, I only do this on the weekends, or I'm with my family on the weekends and I shut this off completely. I think if you can kind of marble into your schedule these zones where you're free from doing it, then that might make sense. If you can't, or if you sort of feel that you know yourself well enough to know that you're going to keep doing it, then I think that makes sense as well. I mean, there's nothing that says that you need to have all these kind of contacts if you find them diluting the real contacts that you're having in life with your closest friends. Then I think, you know, that's part of it. But I think you can also manage it. It's something I'm, you know, trying to figure out myself, too.
All right, thanks for the call, Mike. And let's take another call now from John in Oshkosh. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
When you guys were talking about, like people feeling like they need Facebook and, like, the dependency on it, like, I'm a student at UWO, and the thing that I've noticed is that there's a huge lack of not just, you know, people interacting with each other, but overall I've noticed on college campuses is that, you know, if someone's going to break up with their significant other, they'll do it through an email or through text message or through Facebook or, you know, something like that. And that people are so bombarded with communicating to other people through the internet and through, you know, multiple data streams like you were talking about, that they don't know how to communicate with people in real life anymore. People seem to be very afraid or anxious whenever there's a difference of opinion. You know, people don't want to have not fights, but arguments anymore. You know, people are, you know, think that you're going to take it personally. And I've just noticed that people have problems communicating in general, just face to face now.
Right, there does seem to be sort of maybe a rash of things that never would have been acceptable being done anything but in person, being done sort of over text or email now.
Absolutely.
And do you find that people are more they're blunter in their conversations in texting or in Facebook updates?
Oh, absolutely. People, because, you know, like I said, they don't want to, you know, get into those tense or awkward situations in real life, so they only say what they are really feeling when it's in the text message or on Facebook.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, one of the things I've done some studying before about is just texting and, you know, why texting became so prevalent among young people. When you think about the technology, it's so crude, you know, not so much now with iPhones and Blackberries, but when texting, when you're doing it on a basic cell phone, and you're just fumbling for letters, why that actually worked. And I think it worked for two reasons. One, it sort of came from Europe and Asia where it was much cheaper, almost didn't cost anything to send text words versus a phone line that actually did. But the other thing was sort of control, that you could do it any time and you could say anything. You could circumvent sort of adult supervision through that. But what does get lost in the texting and why these things flare up, especially like in junior highs, is that it loses a lot of the nuance in texting. And you can say things, you might be completely joking about it, but you can say it so straight-faced that it comes across without any of the facial expressions that help you help someone decode what someone's actually trying to say. So I think those things do happen. I do think you're right on something that people, especially in uncomfortable situations, will gravitate towards the most palatable way of communicating it, which is to do it, you know, through technology as opposed to face to face. But having said that, I also remember a friend who was a lawyer right out of college in the early 90s, and he went to lunch. He came back, and there was an email, and he was fired by email from his office, from his boss about 10 feet away. So I think, in general, people always look for an easy out, but now there's just a lot more easy outs.
Well, I mean, I guess it's possible that we're just reinventing the social mores as we go along, and then in 5 years, everyone will be fired by email who gets fired, you know? I mean, I sort of hope not, but it's certainly possible. I do wonder about, you know, what John said about how people are afraid of conflict sort of face-to-face, and so they'll say something terse over email or texting, what have you. Doesn't that weaken our social, our friendships, our social relationships, if we can't have a friendship that would withstand sort of emotional conflict?
Yeah, I guess, although we're so kind of in the thick of it, that it's hard to tell, you know, how much that is just kind of evolving around us. I mean, I think it does go back to, you know, the 12-year-old who ride in the back seat of the car and the parents are driving them, and instead of talking to each other, they're texting their friends in other places. And I think if you're a generation older or more than that, you look at that and say, that's rude. How can you actually sit next to your friend and not say anything the whole ride and text someone else? How are you not communicating that someone else must be more interesting than the person sitting next to you?
Yeah.
But yet, everyone, they all do it to each other. And so that more from our generation is gone in this generation, because that's how they've dealt with it.
Do you think part of it could be that we're still so completely obsessed with it, it's still a new toy, that maybe as time goes on, it won't seem so new and novel that we have to do it all the time, that we'll sort of remember ourselves?
I think that's true. I mean, I think, you know, it's something pretty sobering now when you look at these actual particular technologies that we feel have taken hold. And right now people are all talking about Twitter and Facebook. But I just noticed there was a new book. There's a new book that just came out now about MySpace, where a writer, you know, spent 2 years telling the story of MySpace. Now, by the time the book is out, it feels completely irrelevant because MySpace is mostly irrelevant. It's kind of on the downward slope, and Facebook has been in the ascendancy for the last 6 months. But what is, you know, a year out from now, what is going to be that dominant focus? You know, the windows of dominance now are much narrower than they were before. We went from a period where, you know, IBM ruled the world for 20 years to Microsoft for 10 years to Google for the last 5 or 6, you know, and now Facebook. And who knows where the next dominant piece is coming from, but chances are it's not going to be the one we think it is right now.
Let's go back to the phones now. Here's a call from Jason in Appleton. Hi, Jason.
Hey, greetings and good morning.
Greetings.
Hey, I have two comments. One was just on the last caller. I work in retail and have for about 8 years, and I deal a lot with college age, high school age, and then on up to adult, but I've said that a lot this past season, how I'm trying to talk with kids that are, say, 17 to 21, 22, and even asking them the most simple information to try and find the right product for them, and I can't get it out of them, and I've always joked with my fellow employees, man, maybe I should get out my phone and start texting them, because it seems like pulling teeth, just trying to get basic info that they should be willing to tell me. So that's interesting. My other comment was I go skiing quite a bit, and not so much around here because the runs are shorter, but when me and a bunch of friends, we go out west a couple of times a year, and skiing's a very social thing for me. I couldn't imagine skiing without my friends, but if we're doing laps, you know, and we're talking 15, 20-minute runs, you know, on a certain lift where we're not going to get permanently separated from each other, like for the entire day, if I lose my friends for maybe a few runs, maybe an hour or so, but I know they're going to be at this lift, I'll eventually see them, it's a really a different experience to ski alone. I ski with music on. I'm finding different areas to ski in, different trees that I wouldn't have skied before, and it's really a completely different experience to ski by yourself. I think that you concentrate more, and I mean, when I do meet back up with my friends, I enjoy the time away from them and just skiing a completely different mindset, and I think that kind of ties in with, you know, what you guys were talking about before, the solitude thing.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and I think that's kind of what I'm talking about, not some kind of radical cold turkey approach to this, unless you feel that that's what works for you. But I do think injecting periods into your life where the technology is shut off and you're not even thinking about it, so you're not tempted to turn it on. I think the skiing is a perfect example. I do this a lot. You know, we've had a probably not by your standards, but by our standards, a brutal winter here where it seems like we were getting huge snowstorms every week.
Mm-hmm.
And shoveling, for me, I used to, wear headphones when I'm shoveling because it made it easier to go. And I deliberately now don't do that because I just, that period, that chunk of time when you're outside breathing air, doing work, but not listening to anything, just the sound of snow and the scraping of the shovel and thinking. For me, those have become periods where I deliberately shut off and I don't have my cell phone with me and I don't have earphones and I feel better afterwards.
And even the chance to explore sort of just quiet in your mind. I mean, Jason did ski with headphones and that was a new experience in being with his friends. He was listening to music, but taking that one step further, it's a very different experience just to be with the sounds of the natural world as well, and to feel sort of at home at that and to sort of deeply listen to what's going on.
I think that's exactly right, Veronica, and I think that's rare. If you think about how often you don't hear anyone talking, no radio, no headphones, no chatter, no TV in the background, it is a different sound. It's a foreign sound, but it shouldn't be that foreign.
Okay, thanks to Jason. And another call here, Earl is with us from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, good morning. Great topic.
Thank you.
I wanted to expand at least a little on the quality of interactions when you are in person. You can see facial expressions, body language, look at a person's eyes, and you don't get that through other means. Also, that just using texting or internet or email, you can inflate conflicts and they can really escalate. Just the idea of, you mentioned firing somebody by email, no matter what your justification, that is really a negative way to do things. It's, you're avoiding
somebody. Especially right when you've come back from lunch.
Yeah, you could at least wait till mid-afternoon or something.
Well, I wonder, too, about what Earl said. I mean, because aren't we sort of hardwired to want that response from people? We want to see a face. Maybe we want to touch a warm hand as we're talking to give it that extra significance. We're primates, and we sort of crave that social connection. I can't imagine that it would feel as fulfilling, you know, over a computer.
I think that's true, and I think, you know, some of the research I was talking about earlier about loneliness essentially make the argument that these pangs of loneliness that we experience are evolutionary responses. This is a bit of a sort of new argument, but that because loneliness is bad for us and we need the social connection, that the actual physical pangs of loneliness we feel are these reminders of this being a bad thing, sort of like, you know, the baby touching a hot stove, that you need some kind of response to tell you that this is a bad thing and you shouldn't do too much of it. I think that's whole issue, and that the sense of technology replacing that actually doesn't do that. And the research shows that.
We got an interesting email here from Heather in Kenosha, who says that it wasn't until recently that I understood exactly what you're talking about. The availability of technology to keep in touch with my friends was great, and I felt liberated choosing to live alone, but still having access to people. Until I found out on Facebook that my ex is seeing someone, suddenly the choice of independence / solitude feels much more like loneliness. What do you think when you hear that?
I mean, it's very interesting, and I think it is pretty telling. What is interesting on this, and I think, again, what the research kind of shows, is that that all this electronic communication can, if you're not careful, actually increase social isolation and depression, and that's when it replaces actual human contact. So if it's a amplification and an addition to the kind of contacts we have, then it can just be a way of more effectively managing our relationships. But when it gets to the point where it replaces or diminishes our kind of quotient of human-to-human contact, that actually has been shown to increase feeling of social isolation. So that's the underbelly of this interconnected world, that it makes us lonelier. And this idea is, essentially, some researchers call this social snacking. Hmm. You know, that using technology instead of actual, but, you know, that's ultimately, if all you're doing is snacking, it's a pretty malnutrition life.
Well, and I suppose, you know, maybe 20 years ago, you would have found out your ex was seeing someone else through somebody else. Maybe that person would have been a friend, and then you could have vented a while and maybe cried, and you wouldn't have felt maybe so lonely. But if you just see it pop up on a screen, there it is. You know, it's in cold print, and you could call somebody else. But that initial discovery is happening sort of alone.
I think that's true, yeah. One thing I wanted to mention is the idea of the social connections and kind of what this is for. And the concept is a pretty influential study in the early 70s called The Strength of Weak Ties. And the premise of that was that when you want to, find a new job or find a new mate, the friends of friends, the weaker ties, the people like acquaintances, were actually more valuable to you than your close friends. And the argument is pretty simple on that, and is that if you have a network of close friends, you kind of know what they know. So you sort of know who the same single people that they know. You might know the same sort of or similar people in careers in the workplace that they know, so that their information isn't that different from yours. The friends of their friends could give you information. They'll introduce you to people who are single, or they'll introduce you to a job that you didn't know about. So that was this idea, again, of the strength of weak ties. And I think that, as I say in the piece, could be the business plan for LinkedIn, which is, you know, the more networky career side of Facebook, you know, the application for that. But, you know, the argument that I try to make in there is if everyone is connected to everyone else now, that those weak ties aren't very strong anymore. You know, it's sort of the equivalent of, you know, if someone whispers a stock tip to you, and if it doesn't land you in jail, it can make you a lot of money. But if someone says it on CNBC, it's worthless because everyone knows. So, you know, that may be changing the sociology of the value of these weak ties.
We need to take another quick break right now, and then we'll be back to take more phone calls. And we'd love to hear from you this morning. Do you still feel comfortable being alone in our world of ultra-connectedness? Or do you think we have become afraid of solitude? You can call us this morning at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert with you for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's Talk of the Nation. As baby boomers age, Alzheimer's cases increase. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's husband suffers from the disease. Justice O'Connor is part of the panel with members Newt Gingrich and Dr. David Satcher. After one on Talk of the Nation, an elite panel seeks solutions for Alzheimer's disease. That's coming up at 1 o'clock today. Veronica Rickert, back with you for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with Neil Swiety, who is the author of The End of Alone, which appeared in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. We'll go back to the phones right now and take a call from Julie in Oshkosh. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I was calling in because, you know, we're hearing a lot about the negativeness of all this interconnection, and I'm a person who really enjoys solitude, but I have a son who has a pretty severe psychiatric disability and has a very difficult time with socialization, and all the interconnection on the internet has saved him. I mean, it helps him a lot because he feels alone all the time, and being connected with others on the internet helps him to not feel alone. It helps him to live alone. He has his own apartment now and is able to be out there, but he has this whole world on the internet that he just couldn't have if he didn't have the internet and have all these social interaction sites. And that's my comment.
Thanks a lot for calling, Julie. And Julie raises, you know, the point that it can be something that is really rich and rewarding. I guess if you decide how you want to use it and what you need, you can get a lot of connection out of it that feels pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why, for me, I couldn't stress this enough. Technology can be a very good thing. And it can really open up our worlds in meaningful ways, as the caller was saying about her son. It's just, we need to control technology and not let it control us. I think it comes down to that. And I think we can.
Along those same lines, this is an email from Robin and Lafarge, who says, the great thing about all of this technology is that you can turn it off whenever it gets to be too much. And also, the large-scale stuff is good for making and keeping contacts. The small-scale stuff is good for making connections. And she says, I like to compare it to my parents, who lost touch with a lot of their friends from college, whereas I feel like I haven't lost a friend despite hundreds of miles and lots of time. And I guess that's sort of the benefit. If you want that, if you want to keep track of all those people, you can.
I agree with that, and I, you know, have had a chance over the years to do reporting and traveling in different places and meet some great people, and Facebook has allowed me to kind of reconnect with many of them, you know, in the Middle East and other things down there. So I love that, and I applaud it, and I try to harness that for all that it's for all the good in it. I just think, you know, there are other ways, you know, in the story, and maybe your callers want to try to take this challenge. I kind of challenge the readers to actually, probably three-quarters of the way through the story, I asked people, when was the last time you ever, you know, spent this alone chunk? When was the last time you actually read a long article from start to finish without checking email, without checking your Facebook updates or Twitter or texting someone or taking a call. The answer is usually not very often on there. And I think that can be kind of a sobering thing of, okay, I need to do that now. So if people want to see the article, by the way, they can go to neilswiety.com, or they can just Google "The End of Alone," Boston Globe, and they can find the piece and take the challenge.
Does it ever strike you that maybe this is exactly the technology that we need for this era that we live in? People are kind of scattering to all the corners of the world, and distances seem in a way to be shrinking. I mean, they're not literally, but because people can just hop on a plane and go anywhere they are, the world does seem sort of smaller. So it seems as though to keep track of people in a world like this where people do just travel all over the world, this is exactly what we need.
I think that's true, and I think again, it can all be a good thing. But I do think we sort of, while you mentioned sort of world travel, I kind of end the piece with a foreign exchange student who's studying here in Boston from Venezuela. And contrast that experience with one of the researchers I talked to who had taken one of the classic backpacking, 4 months across South America 15 years ago. And the experiences are pretty profound. What that researcher told me is he was miserable most of the time and alone, and yet he sort of looks back on that as a pivotal experience of self-discovery. And the student today is actually very happy and well-adjusted, and her family is thrilled because she spends 2 to 3 hours a night on Skype, just keeping the video phone going in her apartment, so she's really connected with her family back in Caracas. I think that's very good for sort of mental health and for family unity. Whether it serves the purpose that it once did of self-discovery, I think is a different issue.
Be interesting for people to sort of, like you said, challenge themselves to maybe give up or cut back and to just become more aware of what happens and what the changes are, to sort of evaluate whether the technology is improving their lives or not.
Yeah. No, I think people should try it.
What's the longest you've ever gone without checking in? bust you on the radio.
That's a great question, and I think you would probably for an accurate assessment, you have to talk to my wife and three daughters. this has become a great management tool for work life. I was able to do my job, work on a couple of books, and be invested in my young children's lives at the time, and I couldn't have done that without technology. So I appreciate that. But I also know, and when you ask, in all seriousness, besides vacations, we went to Ireland this summer, and I deliberately did not take I didn't have a phone, and a European phone, and I didn't take a laptop or other things on there. I feel on vacations I should be disconnected from that and not even have that temptation to reconnect. And when I write long pieces, I find, again, sort of like the earlier caller talking about smoking and kind of knowing your limits and where the end of your self-restraint goes, I know that I have to go to a place where there is no Wi-Fi connection. So I seek out libraries and sort of quiet places where they don't have Wi-Fi, which become harder and harder to find now because people say, well, just turn it off on your computer. Well, no, that doesn't work because you can just turn it back on.
It does require self-discipline to try it out, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay, let's take another call. Steele in Neenah. Hi, Steele.
Yeah, good morning, all.
Good morning.
I'm in the early 50s, and so I have a cell phone. I just pay $20 every 3 months, and I have $65 still to burn on it, so I'm listening here. But anyway, and I have a young neighbor kid, and I met his parents, and he's in first grade, and he comes ringing my bell. We were playing in the summer, and he wants to play, they have those little helicopter leaves on these certain type of trees that spin around. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, I had 3 bags of them. One day he wanted to play, so I just gave him a bag of that, and he came back 5 minutes later. He was done, you know, throwing them around. And, I grew up as a single child, but I never remember, you know, knocking on 50-year-old guys, you know, doors to go out and play. And I had my first experience on a forum, an online business, but it shut down for a while, and they specifically said for 6 weeks. Well, I found I'd be looking there, and for 6 weeks, people are just talking back and forth, but with no information, but they're just, you know, talking without really knowing and just, you know, guesstimating and all, and, you know, it's kind of all new to me. I see all these cell phones, and I figured all the world's problems should be done by now with all...
All the talking back and forth.
Anyway, those are my comments.
All right. Thank you, Steele. Neil Swidey?
Yes.
Did you want to comment on Steele's remarks?
I think Steele put it very well. I mean,
I don't know, a bag of those little helicopter things. I wonder how long that would last my son. I don't know if you'd do much better than 5 minutes. They are pretty fun, though. Okay, Terry in Menasha. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, the funny thing is I just wrote an essay about this for my English class.
Ah.
And, you know, the thing that I found was that this isn't just about cell phones and Facebook and stuff. I mean, technology is encompassing our entire lives. Look at the Kindle. Pretty soon the book's going to be obsolete. We won't need libraries because everybody's going to have digital form. They can just download it. Netflix. Why do we have to go to the movie theater when the movies come directly to us, you know, right in our homes? We can work from home. You know, the fact is that we eventually we won't need face-to-face interaction with people at all. You know, the one thing that I kind of concluded is that eventually, maybe down the road, we need technology-free zones, you know? Because, I mean, even restaurants now all have Wi-Fi. You don't have to talk to your table mate. You can sit there and, you know, Google or whatever you want to do.
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something. I would caution against sort of declaring it a done deal on there. I mean, look at movies. I mean, movies have been predicted to be dead for years, you know, particularly when the VCR came out. And yet, movies are actually doing well now because I think there is still a social need and still a sense of a premium that's placed on that's different from that. And remember that it wasn't long ago that people were predicting that movies were dead and Blockbuster was going to be the dominant one. And Blockbuster is on its death door now because technology moves faster than any of our abilities to kind of anticipate it.
I'm intrigued by the idea of a technology-free zone. You know, there's a restaurant where I live here in Madison that opened its doors not too long ago, and they have signs up and inside their menu saying that you should turn off your cell phone, no laptops, you know, none of that. Forget about it. They don't want you to use it there. They want you to concentrate on the people you're with and the food. And my first thought was that was sort of heavy-handed. I mean, because it seems like to enforce that on people, I mean, you could suggest it, but to tell them to do it seemed one thing. But on the other hand, they seem to be doing pretty well, and it's a pleasant place.
Yeah, I guess as long as, you know, as long as it's one of the options that's out there, you know, for people who actually know that they want to go to that, sort of like me going out and finding places that don't have Wi-Fi, it's kind of the reverse of what people, libraries, are thinking. Well, be any kind of self-respecting library, you have to have Wi-Fi now and other things on there now, and for most people, particularly people who can't afford to get it anywhere else, it is essential.
But do you think maybe people are craving that now, that maybe that is an idea whose time has come, places where it's just not okay to be
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's actually a good thing. Again, as long as it's part of the spectrum of choices that you have out there, I think it's a good thing to remind people that it's there. And if people don't want to do it, they won't come, and the restaurant will go out of business. But how many times do you go to, you know, the idea of the reminders? I mean, how many school auditorium events have you gone to where people first say, turn off your cell phones, and then in the middle of it, someone's cell phone goes off, so...
Well, you know, sometimes there just is that call that you really have to take, and it's nice to have the option, and you sort of figure, well, it's going to be someone else's cell phone. It might as well be mine.
Right, exactly. But that's a place where texting is actually an upgrade over cell phones, and where, as I was saying before, you know, because it's kind of like whenever I see a cell phone call and it's my wife's number, no matter what I'm doing, I'm going to take it because I'm going to assume that there could be a possibility that she's roadside somewhere, stranded, you know, that there's important. But, you know, now she just texts me and say, call me when you get a minute. Or I'll do the same thing.
Sorry, we have to leave it there. We're out of time. But thank you so much, Neil.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
Neil Swiety, the author of The End of Alone, which appeared in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.